RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our Legal Hub here at RCR, being a Wednesday. That's our Legal Hub day. And hey, look, lawyer Nick Kearney is back with us after, well, it would be at least a few weeks. Nick, nice to have you back. How are you doing?
Yeah, good to be back, Paul. I'm doing good. And yourself?
Not too bad, you know, just grinding away at the world as you do.
Yeah, the world's still there to be ground away at too.
Yeah, a little bit every day. You know how it works. A few things to get our heads around. I want to talk about Chantelle Baker's actions against the Herald and coming up against stuff, and the disinformation woman, Kate Hanna. First, I want to start off with something we've talked about quite a bit, you and I, and also Katie as well, on this program, and that is the influence, is that the word, of tikanga in judicial decisions in the judiciary. And we have another example of that, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And you know, I think I can claim credit actually for probably the first lawyer in the country to start raising this as a problematic area. Maybe, I don't know, 9 months ago on the show.
I
saw it after the decision in Alice, which really, in my view, opened the floodgates for the judicial system to start considering, and not just the judicial system, but the legal system as a whole, I suppose, to start considering tikanga as part of, you know, ordinary lives in terms of the legal system and what have you. And one of the central problems with tikanga that I saw, and others have criticised it for as well, is that it is not a body of law. It is not law. It is merely custom and tradition. And it has no, you know, legal foundation as such. And really, you know, society that we have in a Western democratic Westminster system and built on the rule of law and common law should operate with the principles of the common law and law, and not so much custom and tradition, which is what tikanga is. And it's not just me saying that that's all tikanga is, because the experts that have appeared in the Alice case, they fairly much said the same thing, that, you know, it's custom and tradition, and it can change from iwi to iwi, from hapu to hapu, and throughout the country. So a very uncertain sort of way to go about inverted commas lawmaking, in my view. But we've got another decision here, and of course in Auckland it involves a statutory organisation, I suppose, in Auckland, Watercare. Watercare manages all of Auckland's water assets, infrastructure, and what have you. It's what they call a council-controlled organisation. The CTOs are essentially like government departments, wholly owned by the council. Watercare had to appoint a new CEO. As part of the appointment process, the independent Maori statutory board got involved, and this board is, as you know, may recall, when the Auckland Council was set up back in 2010 or 9 or 8 or thereabouts, John Key decided, as a bit of a stock, I suppose, to the Maori Party at the time, that you know, instead of having Maori wards in Auckland, which is what they wanted, he'd just have a unelected board of two people that would sit around the council table and they'd be able to vote. So we've seen that throughout councils now and other councils. In fact, I saw it again earlier this week. I think it was an Auckland council, but there was a council down the line, going slightly off topic, but we're on the same issue, a council down the line that had a youth council as an advisory sort of, you know, outfit that would advise the council on youth matters under 16 or under 17. And this council down the line decided to appoint two youth members to the council and give them voting rights to the council. Now, they're not elected. No one voted for them. They're probably not even old enough to vote themselves. And they get to be appointed to the council and get votes. Anyway, coming back to Auckland, you've got the Independent Maori Statutory Board. In March this year, the council began a recruitment process for a new chair of Watercare. And as part of that, the one of the qualifications, I suppose, or job descriptions of the new person, what they had to uphold the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, and they had to show a readiness to promote improved outcomes for Māori and knowledge of te ao Māori, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the council and the panel and everyone else went through this process, and they appointed somebody, and they had a vote, and they appointed somebody. But the Independent Māori Statutory Board appointment person raised concerns about the legality of that process, asked the council to pause the appointment process so the matter could be reviewed. The council decided not to do that and appointed this person, Jeff Hunt, as chair of Watercare. And they'd gone through all the usual processes. There was nothing, you know, they hadn't, they followed the letter of the law, so to speak, held council meetings, went through the appointment process as they were meant to do. Well, the Independent Māori Statutory Board decided that they would apply for judicial review of that appointment process because they weren't happy with it, and they thought that the council, you know, did not follow correct procedure and process and what have you, and took into account. So in terms of a judicial review, the process, what you're arguing is that the decision maker here, the council or the committee or the council, took into account an irrelevant consideration or failed to take into account a relevant consideration. And so what the IMSB argued here was that it failed to take into account a mandatory relevant consideration, which was the council considering whether knowledge of tikanga Māori may be relevant to the governance of that CCO organisation, Watercare.
Right.
By failing to consider whether tikanga Māori was a relevant consideration, the decision was invalid. And it went to the High Court, and the High Court has agreed, and it upheld the judicial review process.
Okay. Well, yeah. Having knowledge to that level of tikanga would limit the number of candidates available for the job, so you're not really going to have a great selection to choose from, are you? That's
well. I wouldn't have thought so. Correct. Yeah, I wouldn't have.
Yeah. So what's the point? You know. So how can you get the best person for the job?
Well, it's an interesting point, and I think in some of these situations, the best person for the job doesn't necessarily get appointed.
No, you know, which should worry the asset, the people who ultimately own the asset. So, yeah. Again, the judiciary has gone down this path again.
Yes, and in the decision, that the judge said there's no requirement a local authority prefers a candidate with knowledge of tikanga Māori, but there is a legal requirement that it actually considers whether such knowledge may be relevant. Implicit in that is a requirement to actually understand what is meant by a knowledge of tikanga Māori.
Is that true?
It's implicit in that it is a requirement of the council or the decision maker to actually understand what is meant by a knowledge of tikanga Māori. So the council argued that they took into account te ao Māori views and what the Māori view was, but the court said that that is different than tikanga Māori. You must also take into account know what tikanga Māori is, and then apply it to your decision-making process, and that's what they failed to do. So, you know, as I say, I've been beating this drum for probably 9 months, I think, on the show, and it's just another example of a system coming in or being introduced through the back door into our legal system. You know, there's a potential requirement now for all law schools to teach it, and that's been well covered on the show, I think, with Gary Judd a couple of times.
Yep.
And media and what have you. And now, you know, I guess in a decision like this, when the High Court makes a statement that it is implicit requirement to actually understand what is meant by knowledge of tikanga Māori.
But you could say, yeah, I understand it. I know what it means, but I'm ignoring it.
Well, or that, or you could say that, or you could say, I know exactly what tikanga Māori means, but what it means to to me in Tamaki Makaurau is different than what it means to, you know, Ngāti Tuwharetoa or to Tainui or to, you know, the iwi in the South Island, Ngāi Tahu or someone, because it is different from iwi to iwi. So to say that you mm-hmm. must have a requirement of knowledge of tikanga is in itself a very, you know, unusual, I guess, maybe, or uncertain thing to say, because...
Yeah, how could you be sure of that, given all the variables?
Yeah, okay, exactly, which is, you know, not, and that's just not me saying that. That's the experts in the Alice case who were asked by the court to give guidance, the Māori experts, to give guidance on what tikanga was. It's what they said too. You've got now, you know, a judicial decision in the High Court that says, in a judicial review decision, that a council must essentially understand and apply tikanga Māori in its decision-making process. That's potentially where this is going, which is, you know, again, the Supreme Court opened this door, and I guess the High Court's just sort of walking through it.
Wow, okay, the more creep. It started off and it's creeping more. What it feels like to me. Where does it end, do you think, Nick, if it carries on like this?
I actually think it ends with a very, very muddled and uncertain legal system.
What,
very muddled, yeah.
Multiple-tier legal system.
Yeah, yeah, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. Don't think we want that, do we?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Well, as a practicing lawyer, I would struggle with, you know, if I had to... And it was a requirement of me as part of my CPD to, you know, to embed, I guess, tikanga in part of my practice. I would struggle. I wouldn't struggle to learn it. I my mind's quite open on stuff like this, but I would struggle to apply it, because it is actually in the ordinary work I do day to day, it is of no relevance. And you know, so if I'm made to do it. Through judicial processes, it's going to make the job of an ordinary lawyer quite difficult, I think.
Who'd become a lawyer these days?
Yeah, I had to become a radio
yeah. Yeah, don't get us in on that, because I'm sure I'll be accused of ignoring tikanga or something at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they're coming for you, Paul.
Yeah, mainstream. Yeah. All right, so that's really interesting. Let's move to, and this has been on RCR Monday morning, we had Chantelle Baker on talking about her settlement with the New Zealand Herald and also what she's planning against Stuff and Kate Hanna for Fire and Fury. This is a fight back, and we're all watching, right?
Indeed it is, and... we're watching and with a lot of interest, I would suggest. And look, I got to say this, it's very easy for people, organisations, maybe particularly people, not organisations as much probably, because it's hard to defame an organisation, but it's very easy for people who have been defamed to just roll over, take it and say, oh, well, I'm fighting NZME, or I'm fighting, you know, Stuff, or, you know, Media Works or whatever, too difficult. Good on Chantelle for standing up with what she believes in and fighting back and holding her ground and winning, you know, and winning.
Yeah. So settling before it went to court with New Zealand Herald implies what, Nick?
Implies they knew they weren't hiding to nothing.
Right.
Yeah. It implies that it was, you know, that was going to go against them, and I guess the thing with defamation is, and we saw it with, you know, we saw it with the Colin Craig case, which was a tawdry affair, I have to say. Him and that, I forget the name of the girl who used to work with him. She was a journalist too, I think. That, and then, but am I incorrect to say, perhaps with the Cameron Slater one too, I don't know. But certainly with the Colin Craig one, they went on for a long time. It was tawdry, the media, you know, the media stories about it were just, it's just an uncomfortable topic. It's almost like, I mean, held the country to interest over the last 6 to 8 weeks was the, as I call him, the Dr. P, right? Dr. P, Polkinghorne.
Yeah, boy, did they go over the top with the coverage of that?
I like to call him Dr. P for obvious reasons.
I get that. Yeah.
Sort of playing words there, but, you know, that was, you know, that held the country's attention, and it was tawdry, and it was, you know, it was Coronation Street on steroids for 8 weeks.
It only held the country's attention, Nick, because they kept slamming it in front of everyone. I had no interest in it whatsoever.
No, and we're going off slightly off topic, but just on, you know, I felt extremely, and this is part of the issue with, I guess, perhaps why the Herald decided to settle. You know, I felt extremely sorry in that particular case for the deceased, the ex-wife of Dr.
Yeah.
P.
Yeah.
You know, the sad life that obviously she had, perhaps sad life she'd lived, and the unhappy life and everything, and all of her foibles and all of the stuff that, you know, she went through was open for the whole public to see and hear, and she wasn't able to defend herself or say anything.
And the Herald and the staff are making money off the clicks.
Oh, loving it, absolutely loving it. And yeah. They're chasing that lady of the night around the world as well, trying to get comments from her, and it's just tawdry. So my point is that it can get, you know, the way the media, as you say, operates on clickbait now and alarmism and sort of, you know, stuff like that to get their headlines. I suspect the Herald probably saw this and thought, we're not going to give Chantal Baker any opportunity to make more of a noise than she already makes. If they would have got advice that it's probably fairly clear cut that you're not going to succeed and settled. So, you know, interesting. As I say, good on defamation's not easy. Not an easy pleading to, as you may know as a journalist, Paul, not an easy pleading to maintain and to win. And the articles that, you know, she said were defamatory, I think it involved, you know, two or three pages about her and what she was doing in terms of the Hawke's Bay cyclone, Gabrielle, and bits and pieces. So it was a long and relatively consistent episode, perhaps, and she, good on, as I say, you know, good on her for standing her ground, so to speak, fighting back and winning. But she's not finished here.
No, she's, I guess you'd be emboldened to move to the next target.
Yeah, well, she tells us she's filed, you know, a new defamation suit focused on Fire and Fury. In which, you know, she's saying that both the publication and Hannah from the Disinformation Project propagated false narratives aimed at discrediting her, and according to Chantal, they were part of a broader effort to manipulate, you know, public perception by casting Chantal in a negative light. And she's put some of that stuff on Twitter. And, of course, you know, the Fire and Fury documentary was, you know, very controversial when it was published initially anyway, and since its release. And so she's now having a crack at stuff over that, which, you know, I mean, there's probably some other people behind this radio station who might also well want to join her, I suggest.
Yeah, who were in that
lawsuit, yeah.
Shown in that program, if you could call it that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the lady who presented it, what was her name?
Paula Penfold.
Paula Penfold, yes. Well, you know, she made no qualms about saying she had no interest in seeking alternative views in the documentary.
Well, they had enough of a mouthpiece, the others outside of the program, which is so non-journalistic from a journalist. It's incredible. And they got paid $300,000 plus for making it, funded. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So good on, defamation, as I say, it's not an easy cause of action to both plead and to win. Good on her for doing it. And, you know, hopefully it make some of these, you know, mainstream media outlets stand up and pay a bit more attention to what they have done and are doing.
Well, we can predict that Stuff will probably settle like the New Zealand Herald, or seek to anyway.
I think the Stuff defamation allegations are obviously based on Fire and Fury, whereas the Herald one was based on a completely different article or articles or situation or events. So I don't think you can, you know, say that they'll be the same because it was the same. You know, for example, if Stuff had simply just repeated what was written in the Herald and put it in their own spin on it and said the same stuff in their newspapers, then yes, you would expect that they would look at it and go, goodness, if it was good enough for the Herald to settle and we've kind of said the same things, but, you know, in a different newspaper, perhaps we should too. But this is based on a completely different documentary and different story. So, yeah, early days on that one yet. But, you know, I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this show who will be sort of egging her on, so to speak.
Wouldn't it be ironic if Kate Hannah ended up, you know, in this very awkward situation, being the disinformation, misinformation queen? That will collapse the House of Cards, potentially, completely.
Yeah, I think that would be ironic. It would not be a strong enough word for that, would it?
No. I mean, I'd have the popcorn out just for that, Nick. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
A while back, I made a piss take of the Fire and Fury promo, using clips from Fire and Fury. And boy, did they get mad with me, for doing that. They're very sensitive. So watch out for some extremely sensitive responses as this plays out, I'm picking. Anyway.
I didn't know that. What sort of got under their skin?
Well, just that it was so good.
Goodness. Yeah.
Might play it sometime. But it was taking the words from, it was kind of like the promo they made for it. You know how people make sort of like a 2-minute promo for their production? Well, yeah. I reworked it, but I used all the bits from the program and just rearranged them into how they should be. and they weren't happy. Let me put it that way. Very sensitive.
And I'm surprised they didn't try and, you know, censor you. I mean, this is the situation with people on that side of the spectrum. I think they, you know, anything they don't like, as we know, they try and censor. And there was, you know, many years ago, probably, eight or so, maybe a bit longer. And I remember this at the time, and I was aghast. The Green Party essentially came out and wanted almost to make satire, you know, a criminal offence, you know, or satire was, you know, kind of illegal in some way, and you know, you couldn't make satirical comments or statements or whatever about politicians.
Yeah, about them.
Very sensitive around satire.
Yeah.
You know? And I guess it's the kind of thing that you were doing with the Fire and Fury. It's just satirical, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And it was obvious, but the sensitivity was, well, it wasn't a surprise, but it was like stepping on a landmine, you know.
Yeah, look, and you know, Rowan Atkinson and others have come out, the comedians who do satire the whole time, and it have just, you know, we all know what they think of the way things are going in terms of censorship and censorship. Mm.
I might just dig around and find it and ask around the team, and maybe we can play it after this time. We'll see what happens anyway.
Yeah.
Don't want to get myself into any trouble. Okay, and to finish off, what do you make of, and we haven't heard much on this, of the Kim.com extradition order? Do we know what's happening there?
We do know because it was published in the mainstream media, I think yesterday, that they, you know, the Herald made an OAA request and got the actual extradition, I guess, warrant or order that Minister Goldsmith had signed. And it essentially gave, you know, any policeman in the country who spotted Mr.com, you know, arrest them on site because he's needed to be detained to be extradited back to America to face.
Well, they know where he lives.
Yeah, they do know where he lives. And, you know, so But of course, because he's appealed the decision by way of judicial review, and look, just having a thought, I wonder if Mr. Goldsmith considered tikanga when he
now
gave,
there you go.
When he
yes.
gave the expedition order. I might contact Mr.com and give him a legal argument to use. And in fact, I might say, and there's precedent for this, and it came out just a couple of days ago in the High Court in Auckland.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So, and you could thank me later. But
it's not as silly as it sounds, though. That's
no,
the thing.
It's not as silly as it sounds. No, it's not as silly as it sounds. And look, I mean, I feel very, very, very uncomfortable about all of this. And I, even when his house was raided back in 2012, you can, I don't know if you can remember, I certainly can. Helicopters.
Yeah, I can. It was over the top. OTT.
Bulletproof yeah. cars, Secret Service agents, helicopters, submachine guns, whatever you want. Unbelievable out there in Coatesville. And I, you know, was saying to friends at the time that the guy is essentially just a glorified photocopier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, he just provided a platform to people to put material on so others could use it. I mean, breach of copyright? Well, maybe, who probably, you know, I mean, you know, you're not allowed to photograph more than 10% of a book at a university, you know, because that's deemed to be a breach of copyright or something. Well, does anyone, you know, going to get extradited to the USA for doing that? You know, does anyone have their house, you know, raided by helicopters and armed, you know, Secret Service agents, FBI agents and whatever? I mean, there's so much more to it than meets the eye here. And I think if you're an open-eyed New Zealander, you should be very concerned about the way Mr.com is being treated, has been treated. And here's another person who is, you know, of the Chantal Baker mind, a true fighter, in my view. And look, he's polarizing. I know people, you know, find him, unusual perhaps, or difficult, or, you know, whatever. But I think, as I say, we should all be very concerned about the geopolitical heavy-handedness of the US government's fingers in all of this, to be honest. You know, is it no surprise that there's been a change of government, a year ago or a bit less, and all of a sudden, you know, this has happened. So you can be sure that, I mean, you know, you can be sure that the US government has put pressure on probably the new government to actually make this happen now, because I wouldn't have thought the previous regime were that enamored to it.
Something's changed, hasn't it? And we seem to be buddying up to the US even closer on all fronts, so maybe that's something to do with it. We had David Harvey on. He was the judge who recused himself from the original hearing, I think, for Kim.com, and he said it's all about copyright. And I asked him about Hollywood and the favors that they were calling in on the Obama administration at the time.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the donor class expect results. And the business model for Hollywood at the time was not in the cloud. So this was a new disrupting threat, what he was doing. And so they went at him that way. You can see the power of the U.S. state was behind it.
100%. Exactly. And, you know, this is, you know, big business is an understatement. This is huge business. Flexing their muscle and saying, you will not disrupt what we do despite the new way of being able to do things in this modern day, you know. And, as I referred to him back in the day as simply a glorified photocopier. But you know, for his inverted commas sins, he got a raid on his house with FBI agents, helicopters, SWAT material, you know, organised by our government and arranged and, you know, whatever, and helped by our government at the time as well.
Well, David Harvey thought that they weren't that aware of what was about to happen. Certainly not. I think Key was the Prime Minister at the time, and I'm, you know, thinking back to what David said, but. He may not have been aware this was going to happen, but I can't believe that. I'm sorry.
I just think it's just implausible, and I've heard John Key say that publicly as well. The size of the operation that was undertaken back in 2012, it simply had to have involved, at least local police or, and if there's local police involved, they would have, the superintendent would have thought, this is bigger than me, I need to go and tell someone bigger.
All the way to the top, yeah.
100%, I'm sure they would. I mean, what are the charges? Criminal copyright, well, what's a criminal copyright? Is that making money off copyright? I don't know. Money laundering, racketeering and wire fraud. And this has got the hint of Julian Assange all over it as well.
Well, I was thinking of that, actually, as you were talking before.
So, I should be a little bit impartial, perhaps, because I'm an impartial commenter on this radio show, but I actually wish Mr.com all the best, and I hope he actually succeeds and stays here, and I hope this thing goes away, because it is the power of the state flexing its muscle again, and, he's big enough, well, literally and figuratively, perhaps, and has enough money to be able to fight it, but there are a lot of people that wouldn't be able to, and they just crumble in and fold, and he might be someone who can, at least shine a light and say, enough of this and enough is enough sort of thing.
It just doesn't feel right, Nick. Just doesn't feel right.
No, exactly. It doesn't. That's a good way of putting it. It doesn't feel right to me either. Yeah, I get very uncomfortable thinking about the way that the state can treat a person like that for, let's say, money laundering, racketeering, potentially that's the reasonably serious criminal offences. But to go to these lengths that they have done since 2012 to extradite him, there's a reason why they want him back in the USA.
And as I say,
it's got the hint of Julian or the smell of Julian Assange all over it. And we, as a sovereign country with our own rules and laws and system, we should be quite concerned about the way this is going, I think.
So if you had the power of the signature here, you wouldn't be signing it off, Nick, is what you're really telling me, right?
Well, I wouldn't have the power because I have no intention of ever.
No, I know that, but okay.
Going to Wellington.
Well, I wouldn't. I wouldn't sign it.
I wouldn't sign it. I wouldn't sign it. No, I would do whatever I can to try and just put a line under it and say, let's just move on from all of this. Let the guy stay here. Is he a citizen here now? Is he permanent resident? Is he a citizen? I'm not sure.
Well, he's obviously must be a permanent, but he's got children here. He's got family here.
He's got children here. I know, I might be out of line in saying this, but the world and particularly New Zealand needs people like Tim.com. He's a character. He's full of life. He's exceptionally intelligent and smart. He's a disruptor, and I think we need to sort of understand that actually the world needs people like him rather than seeks to shut them down and to throw them in jail.
Nick Kearney, great to have you back on the Legal Hub.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks to all your listeners as well.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.